This morning we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 2, entitled Divinity and Divine Service, text number 5. O sages, I have been justly questioned by you. Your questions are worthy because they relate to Lord Krishna and so are of relevance to the world's welfare. Only questions of this sort are capable of completely satisfying the self. Report by Srila Prabhupada. Since it has been stated herein before that in the Bhagavatam the absolute truth is to be known, the questions of the sages of Naimisharanya are proper and just because they pertain to Krishna, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Absolute Truth. In the Bhagavad Gita 15:15, the Personality of Godhead says that in all the Vedas there is nothing but the urge for searching after Him, Lord Krishna. Thus, the questions that pertain to Krishna are the sum and substance of all Vedic inquiries. The whole world is full of questions and answers. The birds, beasts, and men are all busy in the matter of perpetual questions and answers. In the morning, the birds in the nest become busy with questions and answers. And in the evening also, the same birds come back and again become busy with questions and answers. The human being, unless he is fast asleep at night, is busy with questions and answers. The businessmen in the market are busy with questions and answers. And so also the lawyers in the court and the students in the schools and colleges. The legislators in the parliament are also busy with questions and answers. And the politicians and the press representatives are all busy with questions and answers. Although they go on making such questions and answers for their whole lives, they are not at all satisfied. Satisfaction of the soul can only be obtained by questions and answers on the subject of Krishna. Krishna is our most intimate master, friend, father, or son, and object of conjugal love. Forgetting Krishna, we have created so many objects of questions and answers, but none of them are capable to give us complete satisfaction. All things but Krishna give temporary satisfaction only. So if we are to have complete satisfaction, we must take to the questions and answers about Krishna. We cannot live for a moment without being questioned or without giving answers. Because the Srimad Bhagavatam deals with questions and answers that are related to Krishna, we can derive the highest satisfaction only by reading and hearing this transcendental literature. One should learn the Srimad Bhagavatam and make an all-round solution to all problems pertaining to social, political, or religious matters. Srimad Bhagavatam and Krishna are the sum total of all things. Munaya sadhu prishto ham bhavad bir loka mangalam yat krita krishna samprasno yenatma suprasidati. O sages, I have been justly questioned by you. Your questions are worthy because they relate to Lord Krishna and so are of relevance to the world's welfare. Only questions of this sort are capable of completely satisfying the self. in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna explains sarvasya chaham hridi sannivishto mata smritir gyanam apoharam cha vedaischa sarvair aham eva vedyo vedanta krit vedavit eva chaham. That is 15:15. I am seated in everyone's heart, and from me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. By all, I am the compiler of the Vedas, and by all the Vedas I am to be known. The sages at Naimisharanya, they were sitting with Sri Sutta Goswami, Ugrasrava, who is the son of Ramaharshan Sutta. He, Sutta, had heard from Sukadeva Goswami. Sukadeva Goswami had spoken Srimad Bhagavatam to Maharaj Parikshit. Maharaj Parikshit had been cursed by Sringi, the son of Shamika Rishi. Maharaj Parikshit was the representative of God as the king. And it was his duty as the king to protect all the citizens, including the brahmanas, and to encourage them in the activities of devotional service on the path of love of God. So, in pursuance to his duties, he was wandering about his kingdom. He became tired. He sought refuge in the hut of Shamika Rishi while wandering in the forest. Shamika was quite a famous sage and expert as a brahmana in the activities of meditation. When Parikshit came, Shamika Rishi was absorbed in samadhi, and although it would have ordinarily have been his duty to receive the king, but because he was impervious or unaware of the external world, he was within himself, meditating within. Therefore, he neglected to even offer a sitting place or some water to relieve the fatigue of the king. So Maharaj Parikshit also was aware of Brahminical culture, had great respect for the Brahmanas, recognized them as a superior caste, superior group of people, and ordinarily he would not have acted in the way he did. He was upset that he was not received properly. He left the hut of Shamika in a rage, and while leaving he saw on the doorstep, on the porch, whatever, of the sage's hut, he saw a dead snake. So he picked it up with his bow, it was untouchable, and he garlanded Shamika with that snake. Quite an insult, really. So, the son of Shamika, also a brahmana, immature, but certainly having the qualities of his father, being the son of his father, the same genes, the same sanskara produced from the semen of the father. So he has some training also, not yet mature enough, but he had some training, a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. We know the example of Aswatthama, who was the son of Dronacharya. He knew weapon, the Brahmastra, but he had not learned the counteracting mantra. So when he released the Brahmastra, he could not withdraw it. Only Arjuna knew the art, having received it as a blessing from Drona and Lord Shiva, actually. He received the Brahmastra from Lord Shiva, and how to counteract it or withdraw it. But Aswatthama was such a fool, and he had imperfect knowledge, and it caused great havoc. All of Draupadi's children were killed by Aswatthama, sleeping children, and he threw the Brahmastra for the purpose of killing all of the Pandavas also. He had gone mad. He would have destroyed the whole dynasty, the last remaining descendants. So the purpose for which he was doing these things was to please Duryodhana, but Duryodhana had, even although he was in many ways demoniac, but he still had some culture, and he was not at all pleased by Aswatthama's killing of Draupadi's sleeping young children. Actually, Aswatthama brought the heads and offered them to Duryodhana, who was crippled himself at that time. I thought, he'll be so pleased. But even Duryodhana was aghast. He was shocked. He chastised Aswatthama. It was the same thing. Shringi, the young boy, of course, he's not Aswatthama, he's much younger, but still, he cursed Maharaj Parikshit out of false pride. And when Shamika Rishi heard this, he was mortified. He chastised his son, "You committed a great sin." Anyway, it was providence. It was not the fault of Parikshit, and it was also not the fault of Shringi. But it is said that Kali Yuga was ushered in by the action of Shringi. In fact, it's interesting how Parikshit told the personality of Kali that you cannot live in my kingdom. He was about to kill Kali, and Kali took shelter, so Parikshit did not kill him. Kshatriya will never kill or harm anyone who takes shelter. Even they're a great demon, but if they surrender and take shelter, then the Kshatriya will perhaps appropriately chastise them, but will not kill them. So Kali had taken shelter, and Parikshit told Kali that your problem is you are an agent of or friendly towards ignorance and irreligion. So you cannot stay in my kingdom. Principles of religion are being taught. So again, Kali surrendered to Parikshit. "Where will I stay? Your kingdom is spread everywhere." Said, "All right, only where there's hoarding of gold." So he gave him an out. That was the point. He gave him give him some relief, give him an option. So it is interesting that Kali's first victim in Kali Yuga was Parikshit. Kali turned about after receiving relief, after receiving reprieve. He was about to be killed, he was spared, and what does he do? He turns around and arranges for the killing of Maharaj Parikshit. So this is Kali Yuga. You cannot trust anyone in this age. So it's also interesting how the first development of Kali Yuga was that the Brahmins became degraded. Kali entered through Parikshit's foolish action and Sringi's foolish curse. So Parikshit took it as a blessing while leaving the cottage of Shalika on his way back to Hastinapur. He began to meditate on what he had done, why he had done it, and he became very remorseful, very unhappy. Why did I do this? It was a great injustice. And he began to think that this action will bring some reaction and it will affect my family members also. My whole dynasty will be stained by this stupidity of mine. So he prayed to the Lord, please let me receive my reaction immediately so that I can deal with it and avoid peripheral damage to the others in my family. So sure enough, he got a message from Shamika very soon thereafter that he would be killed in 7 days by the snake Takshak. It was a type of snake that could fly also. And Takshak was king of the serpents. Parikshit got this message. And he could have gone to Shamika, asked for forgiveness, and counteracted the curse. Although Shamika said it was an irrevocable curse, but Parikshit could have, by his own tejas, although generally speaking, Brahma tejas is more powerful than Kshatriya tejas. We have the example of Vasishta and Vishwamitra. In their fight, Vishwamitra thought that his great strength as a Kshatriya could defend him, and therefore he stole the Kamadhenu, the cow of Vasishta, but he was very harshly rebuked by Vasishta, who had the power of a Brahmana. And although we sometimes think that someone who has tanks and airplanes and whatever it may be, any kind of material advantage, is superior. But from these dealings we can understand that the highest power is knowledge. Knowledge is power. And purity is power. Purity is the force. Purity is the force. That we can not only protect ourselves from the influence of Kali Yuga, but we can also be victorious in defending ourselves against the agents of Kali Yuga in the form of dangerous materialistic men. Yatra Yogeshwara Krishna, Yatra Partho Ganurdharaha, Tatra Shir Vijaya Bhutir Dhruva Nitir Matir Mama. There will always be victory for us. We will never be overcome. We may lose some battles or appear to lose, but we will never lose the war. We will always overcome as long as we are pure as long as we stick to our principles staunchly, without compromise, as long as we remain fixed, Krishna will be driving our chariot. Krishna will be on our side. Krishna will be protecting us. Krishna is our friend, our master, our lover. He's the object of all of our worship, meditation, love, devotion. And Krishna is Maheshwar. Krishna is Yogeshwar. Krishna is Parameshwar. Ishvara Parama Krishna. That's the opinion of Chaturmukh Brahma, the creator of the universe, the most powerful deity in the universe. His opinion is that there is no other powerful living being like Krishna, Asamodva. No one equal to and no one greater than Krishna. So Krishna becomes the servant of his devotees. What to speak of liberation? Krishna protects his devotees even in the material world. Their spiritual life is protected, but even practically in the material world, Krishna is very merciful. He's Bhakta Vatsala, Bhishma Dev. When he took up vow to make Krishna join the fight at Kurukshetra, even though he had vowed not to, he actually was making Krishna be... Krishna had his promise not to fight, but he also had his promise as Bhakta Vatsala, the friend of his devotees. So Bhishma was going to make him break his promise and act as Bhakta Vatsala to protect his devotee Arjuna. And Bhishma did that. And Krishna, he had two promises to keep, and he couldn't keep both of them. So he broke his promise to not join the fight, and therefore, later on, he had to tell Arjuna that you declare it boldly, because people may not believe me. They've seen me lie. So you declare it, Arjuna. Because people know that I always protect my devotees. Just as we are advised, higher than service to Krishna's devotees, tadhyanam samarchanam. So we can understand this is true because even Krishna follows that. Even Krishna thinks that devotion or service to his devotees is greater than trying to protect any reputation or whatever that he may have. He doesn't need a reputation, but still, he made it obvious by his own actions. He taught us by his own actions that service to the devotees is the greatest form of devotional service. So Parikshit, he was going to be killed. He took it as a blessing, and he sat down on the southern side of the Ganges River, facing north, and he was prepared to fast the last 7 days and without even drinking water. Generally speaking, if you don't take water for 7 days, you don't need a snake to bite you. You'll be dead. Fasting from food is all right. You can last a long time, but without water, your body becomes dehydrated and you're finished. But Parikshit took that vow, and Sukadev Goswami came there, and he questioned him, what is the most important duty of someone who is about to die? It's like the Roman gladiators. We who are about to die, we're going to chant our rounds now. It's probably the most interesting aspect of life is dying. What do we do realizing we're going to die? Everybody knows they're going to die, but when it's right in front of you, when death is looking you in the face, what do you do? How do you act? Do you run away and try and hide? No, it doesn't work. So how do you proceed to face death? So Parikshit was asking questions of Maharaj Parikshit, and all of the great sages throughout the universe, including Narada, Vyasa, Asita, Devala, all of the great rishis, on the pretension of, on the pretense of going on pilgrimage, they all came along with their disciples and came to that place because the word got round by the sadhu grapevine that this is what was taking place, and everyone was interested to hear the discussion between Parikshit and Sukadeva Goswami. So the essence was questions put by Parikshit and the answers given by Sukadeva Goswami. Immediately it was beneficial for Parikshit, but ultimately it was beneficial for the whole world, just as it is stated here, loka mangalam, beneficial for the whole world, the welfare of the whole world. Mangal arti means auspicious or beneficial or the welfare, loka mangalam. So when we are trying to solve a very great problem, which has many different layers, many different levels, it has different depths, the most expedient and logical way of approaching the problem is to try and see the pattern of the problem. In other words, you could just proceed without any analysis right into the problem, meet it head on, and do your best. But you don't know what you're doing and what the result will be. Just like on the, I'm not sure exactly what day it was, something like the 13th or 14th day of the Battle of Kurukshetra, Dronacharya and Bhishma had made a vyuha, a military phalanx or a military strategy. They had positioned their soldiers and army in such a way that anybody who attacked, they would get drawn in to the middle, and then the gateway through which they had come would close behind them, and they couldn't escape, and they would be trapped inside. So the Pandavas, seeing the advancing army of the Kauravas arranged in such a powerful way, were very fearful on how to proceed. But Abhimanyu, Arjuna's son, rode right into the vyuha, and he broke through the first level, But sure enough, the gate closed behind him, and those who were with him, following him, could not get through, and he remained alone, and therefore he was killed. So, in other words, if they had analyzed more carefully, or if Abhimanyu had been followed more closely by those who were assigned to fight with him, then perhaps they could have avoided that disaster. Or if they had arranged their army more strategically, perhaps they could have counteracted it in time. So when dealing with a problem, the first thing is to see the pattern of the problem and to calculate what problems will come up after the first problem. This is something like a game of chess where the opponent may bait you by offering a piece. And if you know anything about chess, but a rook or a bishop or a knight, they're relatively important pieces. Of course, the pawns are there also. They are important, but they cannot move as powerfully across the chessboard as the knight and the bishop, and especially the rook. So someone may make a sacrifice of a knight, and you may think, oh, I'm going to get a knight, let me go and attack here. But you didn't think down the road a little bit, and you know, all of a sudden you've lost your queen, and you're checkmated, or put into great difficulty that will lead to soon being checkmated or defeated. So, there's a problem in life. We're going to get old, we're going to get diseased, and we're going to die. And most of society, they simply deal with this in a very superficial way. There are now so many magazines, at least in America, and I suppose some of them filter down to Europe, dealing with the latest discoveries of how you can prolong your life and how you can stop aging. They've got some kind of idea that they can live in this body permanently, or at least for a few hundred years. And really, who would want to live in this body longer than the 50 or 60 or 70 years that we are already sentenced to? Like a jail sentence, you know. Just follow this program and you can extend your jail sentence for another 50 years in a little bit better cell. Oh, great, you know. What do I have to do? Kill a guard or, you know, it's ludicrous. But they can't see the bigger problem. They can't understand that they have to approach the problem by asking appropriate questions. Answers come to something that is unknown. Knowledge comes when the type of knowledge you inquire about, you'll get that type of knowledge. And if you want to ask about the problem of death, then you should start out by asking, who am I? You should start out by looking in a general, all-encompassing way. Not that you just look superficially at the body. That means you've already concluded that you are the body. You want to stop aging, but the soul never ages. But because you didn't ask any questions, you don't get any answers. Answers don't come unless you ask questions. people don't learn about Krishna by some kind of osmosis or some kind of mystical intuition. The very best people can come up with by intuition is that I am Brahman. Brahman realization comes by neti-neti, by speculation. Krishna bhakti does not come by speculation. You can't speculate your way into Krishna lila. It's impossible. Krishna lila is so spectacular, so unique, so wonderful. There's no way you can get some intuition that Krishna swallowed a forest fire, that Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill, that Krishna had a Ras Lila dance and curbed down the gopis' pride by leaving the Ras Lila, or Krishna expanded himself to be with these. How can you speculate? You can only hear it. You can prepare yourself by purifying your existence, and then if you're fortunate, you can get the association of someone who can inject into your heart the right chip. It's got MPEG Leela going on. Transcendental sound is like, in some ways, like modern technology, perverted. Modern technology is perverted reflection. Now, they have transcendental sound, or they have mundane sound, I have transcendental sound, imprinted on a tiny little chip, no moving parts, it's a file embedded on the chip, and it automatically the sound comes out. And, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, people would have marveled at the whole concept. But now we just take it for granted. And who knows what they'll come up with, but no matter how far they proceed, they can never come close to understanding the magic of Krishna. In the prayers of Lord Brahma, he explains how yogis can travel at the speed of mind, munipungavanam, and yet still they'll prapadasimya avichintya tatve. They can never even come close to understanding Krishna's lotus feet, which are inconceivable. Understanding Krishna means we have to accept achintya shakti. Krishna is beyond the purview, Krishna is beyond the limit, Krishna is beyond the power of anybody's ability to speculate. The only way we can understand the problem of birth and death, old age and disease, is by constantly questioning and hearing the glories of the Lord. Katiyam tascha mam nityam tushanti cha ramanti cha. That's the only thing that will satisfy us. Yinatma supersedati. Or yayatma supersedati. Same thing in the Bhagavad Gita. The only thing that will satisfy the self is this kind of constant discussion. And the amazing thing is that it's not difficult. It's only difficult as long as you contemplate it, up to the point of contemplation, just like being courageous in battle. One may face a very big battle. It may be a military battle, or it may be any challenge, writing an exam, or whatever it is. And while contemplating, while thinking about it, you become almost bewildered. You're overcome by fear and doubt and people withdraw and even avoid. People don't write the test because of so many reasons. But if you just face the test, do your best to prepare, and then go forth. And courageousness is exhibited in the doing. Courageousness comes automatically when one acts. Not, you can't become, some people think, well, first let me sit back and think about the thing and I'll work up my courage and then I'll go forth. It's not it. It doesn't work that way. You do your best to prepare, whatever it is, whatever time you have, then you go forward and you do, then you get courage. So, here's an area where we need to act. We need to adjust our lives so that we can meet with one other person, or five, or 25, and we need to make our agenda. We're going to sit here and we're going to discuss Krishna book, Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna Leela, Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's instructions, anything that we decide, but we're going to talk about Krishna. And even if in the beginning it appears difficult, it appears not as felicitous or as joyful as we were hoping, but if you pursue it, you'll get into it. And you feel satisfaction. And afterwards, when your time is up, you'll wish your time was not up. You'd actually like to go on. But afterwards, you'll think, that experience was so satisfying in comparison with what I'm doing now. Mundane activities, taking care of my body, taking care of my maintenance, my job, you'll pray for more time to be free to sit with other devotees to discuss Krishna's pastimes, because that transcendental sound by talking about Krishna creates a whole atmosphere which you can't understand until you're inside. So, questions and answers. That's our life. Today is the appearance day of Jagadish Pandit. It's also Dvadasi. Now, Jagadish Pandit, there are two references to Jagadish Pandit. One is that he was the 31st branch of the Chaitanya tree. And there's not much more said than that. He was Chandrahasa, a great dancer in Krishna Leela. But there's another reference to Jagadish Pandit that he was the 15th in the line of followers from Nityananda Prabhu. And he was a great preacher. Actually, what happened was that his father came to Navadvip to associate with Jagannath Mishra. And therefore, Jagadish Pandit got the opportunity to associate with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And he went with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to Jagannath Puri and spent a number of years there worshipping Jagannath and serving Mahaprabhu. Then Bhai Chaitanya sent him back to Bengal, and he carried a deity of Jagannath to a small village there, Chakadaha district of Nadia. It's a railway station. So he established that deity, and the deity is still there. Actually, the temple of Jagannath is still there. He carried the deity with a stick. It was a big deity, heavy deity. And somehow he tied the stick, the deity to the stick, and then he took the stick and carried Jagannath. So the pujaris there, sometimes they have that stick and they bring it out and show it. And at one point there was a proposal that we were going to get, they were going to give that temple to us to maintain, although it was, I think at that time, Jayapataka Maharaj went to see the deity, and it was in under the care of Madhav Maharaj, one of Prabhupada's god brothers. And Madhav Maharaj was a nice preacher. He had some bias towards Srila Prabhupada, maybe competitive envy or whatever. I can't criticize him. I met him when I went to Vrindavan. He was the first Gaudiya. He was the first godbrother of Prabhupada that I met, and we went to his Vyas Puja. And I gave him a copy of Srimad Bhagavatam because I'd been distributing books in the West, and you know, I brought the Bhagavatam and I gave him a copy, and he said, "Oh yes." He said, "I am senior to your Guru Maharaj." That's what he had to tell me. And I was unimpressed, but it was an interesting ceremony at his Vyas Puja. There were other god brothers there. Guru Das and I were there. We were invited to go. And when it came, there was really sweet bhajan singing. In the Gaudiya Mats, you will find they do those things very well. They're not so good at preaching, and they tend to be a little bit... They're generally all over the world populated by simple Bengali devotees who are often villagers and really couldn't do much more than live in a mud. That's a general kind of observation. But anyway, they sure do nice kirtan. And then it came time for the Vyas Puja. So there were other god brothers there, and there was one Vyasasana seat in the temple. And so, you know, Madhav Maharaj moved closer to one of his god brothers and said, "Prabhu," or "Maharaj, you sit down." And then they were all arguing and not fighting exactly. It was a kind of a ritual or a leela that who would sit and take the puja. And it really didn't seem to matter who took the puja because, you know, it was like Sri Guru Dev is being worshipped. Some person may sit on the seat, but it could be this one or that one. They're just representatives of the seat of the asana. So finally Madhav Maharaj agreed, and all his god brothers pushed him, "Come on, come on." They took him by the hand and sat him down. Well, it was kind of interesting. But he established a lot of temples in India. And he even came to Prabhupada's Tirubhav celebration a year after Prabhupada left. Tirubhav means disappearance. And he told the story how he never realized what Swami Maharaj had done until he attended a function in Orissa. And there was an ISKCON Brahmachari there who spoke, and he said he was so impressed by that Brahmachari, and it was my god brother Bhagavat Das, who is a good speaker, although now he's in Alachua, not so absorbed as he was in those days, but eloquent person. He spoke, and Madhav Maharaj was so impressed. He said he spoke better than most of the sannyasis in our Gaudiya Math, and then I could understand what Swami Maharaj had done. And in this way, he glorified Prabhupada. And we were all, you know, just very impressed. But in general, his temples are kept very clean and nice. You don't find that in most temples in India, due to impersonalism, due to laziness, due to whatever. A lot of the temples are not so clean. The dresses for the deities are not so nice. But in Jagadish Pandit's temple, which was under Madhav Maharaj, Jagatak Maharaj explained that everything was being done nicely. And so Jagadish Pandit was a great devotee and showered the world with torrents of devotional love. And he's explained, his activities are explained in the Chaitanya Bhagavat and also the Adi Lila of Chaitanya Charitamrita, chapter 14. So, Jagadish Pandit ki jai. Is there any further elucidations? Yes? Okay.
You were speaking about Srinidhi and its Shanta tradition. And one point of that, I think I found it, I think it's 118.49. Srila Prabhupada said that Lord has forgiven Srinidhi for what he has done.
Who?
The Lord.
Yes, yes.
Supreme Lord. That he has forgiven.
Yeah. Well, the action is not forgiven in a general sense, but the reaction could have been reduced. Just like we are also guilty of so many sins in our past life. In fact, we have a huge warehouse, each and every one of us, a big storehouse. Just like there's a storehouse of love of God, there's a storehouse of karmic reactions that if we had to experience the full force of those reactions, our suffering would be immense. In the description of Ekadasi, how Ekadasi came to pass, it's described that Lord Vishnu went to the place of Yamaraj, and while he was there in the lands immediately beyond the palace or the place of Yama, he heard hellish screaming and cries of pain and agony coming from every direction. And he inquired, what was that? And Yama explained that the living beings getting their just reward. Mandavya Muni, or Manduka Muni, he was made to sit on a stake which went up his rectum and up his spine. And when he inquired from Yama why, Yama said, because you caused similar pain to an insect. You took a piece of grass as a child and poked it. So, I mean, okay, I was a child, I should be forgiven to some degree, but very often adults do very similar things. The slaughter of innocent animals, horses. People think that, well, the problem is that I was a young, bewildered, disturbed hippie. And what disturbed me was the games that I saw people were playing with each other, and the lack of sensitivity towards one another and the brutality that individuals inflict on one another, and I couldn't understand it, why. And I asked a friend that, why do people do these things? What do they think? And, I got a shock. I don't know whether he was realized or it was just coming through him from Krishna, but he said, don't you know, most people don't think. I was thinking, well, what do they think about all this? And he told me that they don't think. They just act. Bound by lust, anger, and greed, sarva prakriti jayagunai, based on impulses born of the modes of nature, they just act. There's no stopping and considering how this will affect others. Maybe I should change, maybe I should not do it, maybe I should control my senses. So the things that we have done without thinking, there's retribution to be paid, there's karmic reaction. We cannot be forgiven as such for killing cows. How many cows have we killed in our lives? Now Krishna may reduce karmani nirdahati kintu chabakti vajam. He may reduce the reaction so that it's almost nil, but the action itself cannot be forgiven. How's that for a speculation? It works?
No, it is the reverse. You say the action cannot be forgiven. Here you said the action was forgiven, but the consequence was there.
The consequences are there. Okay, the action was forgiven in the sense that the consequence was reduced, but the consequence came because the action had to be dealt with. Actually, in some ways, adjusting things in the material world, you require a basic understanding, and the rest is adjusting words. If you have, and you also have to try to not rely on yourself. As I explained earlier, the solution to our enigmatic, quizzical situation in this world, the solution to our problem is to situate ourselves in the mode of goodness by regulation, by pure eating, by pure sacrifices, etc. And then allow Krishna to move us. Krishna instructed Arjuna and guided Arjuna because bhaktosi me sakha cheti, because you're my friend, you're my devotee, therefore I am very inclined towards you, I'm very biased, or I'm very much inclined to guide you. So the only way it's like a huge ocean that's filled with sharks and, poisonous eels and, all kinds of dangerous aquatics, whatever. Sharks are the most famous. But it's a very difficult ocean to go through. But we can navigate nicely if we allow Krishna to guide us. And it's not as difficult as it may sound, or it's not as impossible We just have to situate ourselves in the mode of goodness and try not to get in Krishna's way. Try to be transparent. Try to see any opaqueness and remove that by chanting and hearing, discussing. Don't filter. Let Krishna guide you, and he'll give you the answers how to do everything that you have to do.